All right. Our next case is 23-1393 Schwartz v. Gintempo. Mr. Zipporin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Eric Zipporin, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Deputy Jason Gintempo of the Denver Sheriff's Department. May it please the Court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I have the opportunity to do so. I am here to respectfully request that the Court reverse the District Court's denial of qualified immunity related to the appellee's claim of excessive force. Specifically, we are here to request a reversal of the District Court's finding that the law was clearly established such that it was beyond debate that Deputy Gintempo violated Serafin Finn's rights under the 14th Amendment as a pretrial detainee. By using force after Mr. Finn ignored a command to stop spitting and then spitting in the face of Deputy Gintempo. Deputy Gintempo is here today to simply ask that the Court apply the same qualified immunity process that it would apply to a Denver Police Department officer who is accused of using excessive force under the Eighth Amendment, and that there is no carve-out exception related to qualified immunity for claims brought against pretrial detainees. The essence of the argument made by appellee and the cases that they rely on, as well as the District Court relied upon, is that Mr. Finn did not pose a threat to Deputy Gintempo, given that he was restrained in leg irons and in handcuffs. But those restraints did nothing and could do nothing to prevent the chosen method of assault by Mr. Finn. Spitting in someone's face is just not one of the most degrading and dehumanizing things you can do to a person. It's an assault under Colorado law.
Which could be charged.
And it was in this case, Your Honor.
All right. And isn't that the remedy?
That's one of the remedies, Your Honor, but certainly the officers need to protect himself, to protect the security of the situation, to protect his fellow deputies, another consideration.
Now you're arguing facts. And what the District Court, there are a number of paragraphs, a jury could conclude. For one thing, a jury could conclude that the deputies punching this man and flipping his wheelchair onto the pavement was unrelated to purported interest in, as you say, restraining that activity. Similarly, a jury could conclude that the use of force was excessive in relation. That's Johnson versus Jones, isn't it?
You're arguing
sufficiency of evidence.
And we're not here to argue sufficiency of evidence. In fact, we are not challenging prong one of the qualified immunity analysis. We're not here to argue that the Judge Sweeney got the facts wrong. We're not here to argue that her analysis was flawed in terms of finding a constitutional violation. We are here for the limited purpose of, if we accept the fact that this is a constitutional violation, that the law was simply not clearly established to put the officer.
If a jury could find that it was unrelated, as the District Court says, and that it was just an act of rage, then you're saying there wouldn't be clearly established law that just because you're angry about something, you can't strike someone in a wheelchair who's handcuffed.
Well, what I'm saying is the jury is going to have the opportunity to consider the first prong of the qualified immunity analysis, that being whether or not there's a constitutional violation. And if a jury does conclude that this was an act of rage, that this was an act of punishment, then yes, they will conclude that there's a liability for Deputy Gintempo, but they won't be asked the second part of that equation, which is the clearly established equation, which is what Judge Sweeney was tasked to do, which she didn't do in a proper manner. The fault of Judge Sweeney was her failure to provide any case that was sufficiently similar to the facts presented to Deputy Gintempo.
So that's your position, that if the jury found that it was an act of rage and that it was outrageous or egregious or something else, still no liability because the law is not clearly established that you can't strike someone in a fit of rage who's handcuffed in a wheelchair. No cases involving those facts, so therefore no liability.
My only discrepancy with that, Your Honor, is that the jury, and I've tried a number of qualified immunity cases, and I've never seen a case where a jury's been allowed the opportunity to decide qualified immunity.
I'm agreeing with you on that.
Okay. So what I'm saying is the failure here was that even if Judge Sweeney determined that there was a constitutional violation, that's only half the analysis. The second part of that analysis that she has to go through, as mandated by this court, as mandated repeatedly by the United States Supreme Court, especially in the last few years, in Mullinex versus Luna, White versus Hawley, City of Tahlequah versus Bond, is that she was mandated to find a case that was sufficiently similar that would have put my client on notice that what he was doing violated the 14th Amendment, absent an obvious case of egregiousness.
So you get a free strike rule for a spitting case.
Well, I don't know if I would characterize it as that, Your Honor, but what I would characterize it is the parties have conceded there was no 10th Circuit case that deals with the facts that were sufficiently similar to this one. The district court wasn't able to come up with a case that was sufficiently similar either. What is being argued by the appellee, which not even the district court adopted, is that it was per se clearly established because Bell versus Wolfish in 1979 mandated that punitive force could not be used against pretrial detainees. But that, accepting that premise would be a violation of the Supreme Court's repeated mandate to not decide these cases at too high a level of generality. That would be akin to deciding a Fourth Amendment objective reasonableness case on those grounds alone. That Graham versus Connor says you can't use force that's objectively unreasonable. If a district court were to find that as part of their analysis, then that's the end of the analysis.
But why isn't the right frame for this case that the prisoner was subdued and not a threat? And it is degrading and potentially dangerous to get spit on, but I think both his arms and feet were restrained and he was in a wheelchair, so... He really wasn't a physical threat, other than what he did, and certainly he was substantially restrained. So it seems to me that the most obvious thing to do would be to step back, and put the towel over his head, which they did, rather than use potentially punitive force.
Well, my first comment.
Let me restate that. Isn't this just the infliction of force on a subdued inmate? Why isn't that? I mean, I think that's more or less their framing. What's wrong with that?
I'll get to that in one moment, but prefatory comment quickly. This was not just simply a spit. This was a spit from a gentleman who had hepatitis C. This was a weaponized assault.
Well, he didn't know that at the time.
Correct, Your Honor. He did not know that at the time.
So that couldn't have, we can't consider that as part of his frame of reference when he struck the man in the wheelchair.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But I think that in that population that he's dealing with, I think they've received training of the risk of spitting on someone's face in this particular setting with this particular population is an enhanced risk. Getting to your point, Judge Timkovich, yes, the point that the district court has relied on and that the appellee has relied on is the cases that they presented for clearly established law talk about individuals who are in restraints, and the key part is, and effectively subdued. They cite to Casey versus City of Federal Heights. They cite to Weigel versus Broad, McCoy versus Myers, which is an egregious beating of an individual in a motel room who's unconscious and is being struck by officers. But the distinction with this case, Your Honor, is that, yes, there were leg restraints. Yes, there were handcuffs. But those restraints do not in any way restrain or subdue Mr. Finn's ability to spit and assault the officers.
That's why you step behind him instead of tackling him over the other deputy's resistance, trying to hold the wheelchair up and facing him. He could have spit in him 10 more times the way that the deputy handled it, instead of just stepping behind the wheelchair.
And I'm not here to argue that perhaps there's other things that could have been done and perhaps better things that could have been done. But the point is whether what was done was objectively reasonable. But even more to the point, if what was done was clearly established to be a violation of Mr. Finn's 14th Amendment rights, and we simply don't have any case that's been presented to this court suggesting from the Supreme Court or anything sufficiently factually similar from the 10th Circuit, and certainly not the weight of authority. They've provided you with cases from the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 11th circuits. So we certainly don't have the weight of authority here. And relying simply on Bell versus Wolfish or this broad proposition in the law is simply not what the Supreme Court mandates when we're talking about these types of cases. Now, absent an obvious and egregious violation.
So why can't the court say, that's exactly what I see when I watch that video?
And the district court did not do that. This court certainly can do that upon reviewing the record. It can make rulings that are not base its findings on rulings not made by the district court, but I would caution against that. Judge Timkovich, in Colbruno versus Kessler, you talked about the obvious case and the egregious case, and you made it very clear that those cases are the exception. They're the rare case. It's an exceedingly narrow exception.
Wasn't
cases.
That a dissent?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. Yes, it was, Your Honor. And to be candid, my whole argument today is your dissent in Colbruno, which was that in that case, the panel, the majority panel held that Bell versus Wolfish provided clearly established law because the force was found to be punitive. You in your dissent said, no, that's not the way we look at this. We look at this, that's too broad of a general proposition in the law. And Mr. Colbruno failed to come forward with facts that were sufficiently similar to put this officer on notice he was violating the 14th Amendment.
But with respect to my senior colleague, we're stuck with Colbruno, not the majority opinion, not the dissent.
Agreed. But I would argue that the dissent in Colbruno was much more in line with the Supreme Court's mandate over the last 9 years that this court and all circuit courts find cases that are sufficiently similar in nature and don't rely on broad propositions of the law. How broad can it be to say the force was punitive? How is any deputy supposed to glean anything from that? General proposition of the law in terms of preventing future misconduct. And so that's the argument here is, again,
I am not without sympathy to your client, but if you look at that video, it strikes you as punitive.
And
just from a man on the street view of it.
And I think the video, if this case were to proceed to trial, I think with some explanation, with some testimony to support it, with some additional facts, you're faced with facts too that we have to accept here for purposes of today that we don't believe were in dispute, that have been found to be in dispute. And I think the video can be tempered a bit with some explanation behind it. But I understand where you're coming from, Your Honor. I'm at 3 minutes. I'd love to reserve that time for rebuttal absent any questions.
You may.
Thank you.
That's the closest I've ever seen someone come to hitting the mark.
It's the best I've ever done.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Omid Azmuda on behalf of the estate of Finn. On summary judgment, the District Court correctly denied qualified immunity to Deputy Gintempo after finding that Deputy Gintempo, as we've discussed a little bit this morning, or at least a reasonable jury could find that Deputy Gintempo punched Mr. Finn twice in the head with a closed fist and then slammed him to the pavement, all while Mr. Finn was handcuffed, shackled at the ankles, and seated in a wheelchair. The only issue before this Court is whether Deputy Gintempo's unconstitutional conduct violated clearly established law, and for two independent reasons this Court should affirm. First, as Judge Phillips was mentioning earlier, the District Court made a factual finding that a reasonable jury could conclude that Deputy Gintempo's conduct was punitive in nature. It was not rationally related to any legitimate government interest, and it was arbitrary. And under not just Bell v. Wolfish, under Bell, Blackmun, Colbruno, and a series of similar cases that followed all in this circuit, punitive force violates clearly established law, full stop. And even if the District Court did make that finding, if this was merely an excessive force case as opposed to punitive, then still, any reasonable officer knows that it is unlawful to pummel a 60-year-old man seated in a wheelchair with his arms and legs tied together.
You agree, though, that your now deceased person engaged in dangerous conduct himself, don't you?
I don't know if I would concede that it was dangerous, maybe some remote possibility.
Do you want to walk outside and let someone you don't know on the street spit in your mouth?
No, of course not.
You would agree that that would be dangerous for you to engage in that conduct, wouldn't you?
I would posit that it's poses some, possibly. Some
risky conduct?
Risky conduct would be better. And really, there's a factual finding in this case that I think describes it best, which is unsanitary. A reasonable jury can conclude that it's unsanitary.
That's a sanitary way of saying it, but
I'm going to offer the sanitary way of saying it. But I think more important is to think about some of these cases, and I'm going to turn to the punitive force issue first. But if you look at Blackmun and you look at Hubbard, which is an unpublished decision that followed, those cases also acknowledge that there's some legitimate government interest out there that exists In Blackman, it was preventing an inmate from self-harm. In Hubbard, it was preventing an inmate from getting into fights with other inmates. And so the existence of some legitimate interest is not necessarily the end of the analysis. As the district court did here, she acknowledged spitting is unsanitary, and maybe so. Maybe it's dangerous, too. Well, but still,
it's an assault. It could be a criminal assault. It's battery. It's, you know, bodily fluids can be are dangerous, and they, in retrospect, they were dangerous here. And the plaintiff, he wasn't really subdued in the sense that we care about here. He was handcuffed, but he didn't have a spit mask on. So he was still able to engage in this type of wrongful conduct. And can a reasonable officer halt the conduct, which is, and it did prevent a second spitting episode. I mean, it was, I saw the video too, but it halted the misconduct quickly. And, you know, what case out there says that an officer can't interrupt an assault through, you know, a use of force?
Sure. So would shooting Mr. Finn. It would also stop the conduct. But striking Mr. Finn, punching Mr. Finn and then slamming him to the pavement, according to the district court, which is a factual finding that's outside the jurisdiction of this court's review, was not rationally related to that government interest in stopping the assault. According to the district court, a reasonable jury could credit that set of facts. And when that factual finding is made by a district court, not only is it unreviewable, but it's dispositive to this appeal.
What if he'd have grabbed him and put him in a chokehold?
I think it would depend on the type of chokehold, Your Honor. I think there's a lot of decisions from this case, that this circuit, that talk about the various methods that could result in asphyxiation. So I think that'd be a bad case.
He was spitting on him. He needed to control his head. Instead of punching him, he grabbed him and put him in a headlock to keep him from turning his head around toward him.
Headlock still, I think, goes too far. I think a really close call is what Deputy Gentempo has testified he did throughout this case. He said that he went forward with an open palm, two-handed gesture. I think if that were actually the facts of this case, or a version that a reasonable jury could credit, this case would be much harder. But there's a significant difference in an open palm, two-handed gesture and a closed fist strike. I mean, a haymaker. The video depicts him sort of loading up onto one side and then unleashing all that he's got. And I think that's significant. And I think that played into the district court's finding that this was not.
Don't we have to get, I mean, even giving to you that we expect our officers to act with some restraint and measured in level of measure. I mean, this happened very quickly. He was spit upon, and he could have either been spit upon again or done something about it. And he acted quickly, and maybe he overreacted. But don't we have to give some grace for that?
Not in this circumstance, because I think he overreacted in a sense that he acted off of rage. And that's the most intuitive view of this evidence, and it's certainly one that a reasonable jury could credit. He took quick, dignitary offense to what happened to him, and he decided to retaliate with pain. And that's just simply not a tool that's available to our officers. I think if you saw this in a bar fight, you'd assume the same thing. If one person spit on another in a bar, and the other person loaded back and unleashed a haymaker, you'd say, that wasn't because that guy wanted to get control after having been spit on. It was because he took offense and decided to retaliate with pain. Under Blackman, Colbruno, Knighton, Bloom, Hubbard, and probably more, that tool is simply not available to our officers. We hold them to a higher standard. And I would highlight Bloom and Hubbard in particular. They're cited at page 16 of the response. Those cases are procedurally identical to this one, in which a district court made a factual finding that there was punitive force, regardless of whether the district court, the evidence might point in more than one direction, which I think is what the conversation this morning has revolved around. This court doesn't get to decide which way that evidence points. That's for the district court and then ultimately a jury. And in both Bloom and Hubbard, the court accepted that finding and said, panels from this court said, it's not our job. If that finding has been made, then there's a violation of clearly established law, and this case goes to trial, which is what should happen here.
You think this case would be different if the officers knew he had hepatitis or COVID or...
Maybe, Your Honor. I think if you look at the Colorado statute, there's varying degrees of assault or battery based on the actual conduct that's proved. And the statute that's cited throughout the briefs, the elements of it include, you know, it is assault if you cause spit to go on a peace officer with the intent to annoy or harass, annoy or alarm.
Is that what he was charged with?
I don't recall, Your Honor. Don't quote me on exactly what he was charged with. But that's the statute cited in the briefs, so I would assume so. But I think there would need to be a factual showing of what he intended to do before we could conclude that, you know, this guy had in the state of his mind, I'm going to infect this officer with hepatitis C. And a related point, there's not been any expert testimony at Crawford below that hepatitis C can be transferred via saliva. I don't think that a jury could come to that conclusion on their own without some support. In fact, we would probably file a motion in limine to exclude those types of arguments.
Wouldn't you be looking at the at the officer's state of mind, though? I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I don't know whether it causes it or not, but I don't want to try it. And so don't we have to, doesn't the officer's subjective belief mean anything here?
I don't think so. If there's any...
Do you have a case to that effect?
No, I think all of the cases on excessive and punitive force are about objective reasonableness and objective circumstances. But what I will offer about the subjective fact of this case is that Deputy Gintempo did not know that fact, that he had hepatitis C.
Is it a stipulated fact that the spit hit him in the face?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's conceded.
Yes. As I was discussing, there's just too many cases from this panel to even list all of them, from the circuit to even list all of them that make clear that punitive force violates clearly established law. And there was a point that the district court did not make the finding on clearly established law on that line. Just to alert the court, it was preserved. We made the argument at Appendix 144 in our response to summary judgment. And we think that that's actually the easiest way for this court to resolve this appeal. But even if Deputy Gintempo's force was merely excessive as opposed to punitive in nature, then we're not going on a scavenger hunt. We're looking for materially similar cases or those that apply with obvious clarity, such that Deputy Gintempo had fair notice that his conduct was unlawful. We rely on the cases that Judge Simcovich mentioned earlier, McCoy, Morris, Graham, and several others that draw a clear line that once an individual is restrained, and meaning in handcuffs and shackled and seated in a wheelchair, the use of significant force, punches, forceful takedowns, and certainly the combination are clearly unlawful. McCoy describes being restrained as the decisive factual circumstance.
Wasn't he also unconscious, non-responsive in the facts of that case?
In McCoy?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
That seems a big difference.
Maybe so. I think some of the other cases in which, including, I'd say Casey is probably close to, it's not dispositive whether the arrestee or the detainee was unconscious. I think having restraints is qualitatively important in analysis of whether significant force is appropriate.
He wasn't really restrained in the portion of his body that he used for the assault was not effectively restrained or subdued, was it?
No, Your Honor. But he wasn't restrained either from cursing at the officers. And I think what's important is all of these cases are indicating that there's something qualitatively important about when your hands and legs are tied together. And when that line is passed, the use of substantial force is unavailable to officers. And even if you don't agree that those cases are materially similar, maybe they pose some differences in the level of threat, the force used, or in the level of the threat that's posed by the detainee or arrestee, if any. This case strikes us as an obviously unlawful one. As the excessive force being so obviously unlawful that it should be found to have violated clearly established law. And I think one way to think about that is Kingsley encourages us to think about whether the officer made any effort to temper the use of force. There's none here.
It was impulsive. I mean, it was immediate. I don't think there was a lot of thought that went into it. It was a a knee-jerk reaction to what happened.
Precisely, Your Honor. And we ask our officers to be better than make impulsive decisions and on the one hand, decide quickly to punish an inmate through pain, or on the other hand, decide quickly to use excessive force against.
Well, qualified immunity doesn't let us do the 20/20 hindsight review, which, you know, and there's some play in the joints there for, you know, conduct that in retrospect was undesirable, but in the heat of the moment, understandable.
Maybe so, Your Honor, but obviously there's a concept in this area in which we have to defer some to officers. But I think this is not the case in which we have to say that it was such a close call that we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
I mean, isn't this the kind of case where you do have a? I mean, seems to me more difference goes where there are split second reactions that take place. You've got someone spitting multiple times. He spits in the officer's face. It requires a quick reaction. Quick reactions are not well thought out generally. That would seem to counsel for giving the officer some benefit of the doubt.
It was a quick reaction, Your Honor, because he decided it was going to be a quick reaction. He had alternatives.
I guess he could have stayed there and let the guy spit in his face again.
No, he could have walked away and retrieved the spit hood.
Well,
from
that would have
car.
Been a quick reaction too. Either way, it was a quick reaction, but he was going to react, and we don't like the way he reacted, but it doesn't take away the fact that it was a quick reaction and called for a quick reaction.
I don't think it called for a quick reaction.
He spit on the ground. He turned his head. He spit in his face. I mean, why do we believe he wasn't going to in quick succession spit again at him?
It's possible. There's not really any evidence that would have happened, because by the time that could have happened, Deputy Jimbo was already delivering too close of his strikes to the head.
He indeed did.
But. Yeah. But I think maybe the other factual point that's important, is that before the spitting, there's these allegations that, Mr. Finn was, belligerent and causing such a storm that he was a threat. Well, first off, the decisive factual circumstance for McCoy was true, handcuffed and shackled. Second off, the rest of the videos show Mr. Finn gladly standing up out of the gurney from the hospital inside Denver Health, accepting a new set of handcuffs, seated in the wheelchair, letting two deputies sort of roll him down the Denver ramp. So all we're really talking about is one instance of spitting. And when that happens, it's our position that Deputy Gintempo had more options. I see that my time is up. If I could just conclude briefly.
Yeah.
Deputy Gintempo violated Mr. Finn's 14th Amendment right in two ways, by punishing him and by engaging in excessive force, because both ways were a violation of clearly established rights. This court should affirm the district court's denial of qualified immunity.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Zaporn had three minutes and 1 second.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to, again, say I'm not here to argue facts, but I can't help myself. Basically, on your questioning, Judge Carson, about wouldn't it be reasonable for him to expect another spit? Well, in fact, there is record evidence of a third spit. After the first, he spits on the ground. He's told not to spit. He spits in his face. Then he spits a third time in his face, going into his mouth, which was then, according to my client, what precipitated the strike. Now, Judge Sweeney resolved that fact against us, finding it to be in dispute. The other side argued, based on the video, Mr. Finn appeared to be pulling his blanket up, which, based on their argument, that she accepted he could not have possibly split a third time. But I just wanted to flag
that. So we only have two spits.
So in this case, for purposes of today, only two spits. The other suggestion that my colleague made here is that the district court's determination that the force was punitive was a fact finding. I take issue with that. I think the court's determination that the force was punitive was a question of law, much like finding the force to be objectively reasonable would be a question of law. It's those facts that supported her, Judge Sweeney's decision that it was punitive, which are not in dispute, which were fact-finding. But the issue itself, in terms of whether or not the force was punitive, is not a fact. It's a question of law.
So if, based on the same facts, we determined that it was punitive, you lose?
No, because we still have, and my argument today is we still have to find a case that's clearly established that would have put my officer on notice.
That if he took punitive action, he might be okay?
Yes, that he took, if he took punitive action that's prohibited by Bell versus Wolfish, which we concede, of course, but that's too general, a broad proposition of the law. Just like Graham versus Connor would be too broad of a proposition of the law to find the force if it was objectively not reasonable.
So what's your best authority on the, if there's punitive action, stated otherwise, an action not having any relation to a legitimate penological interest, what's your best case there that would say, well, that wasn't clear enough, so there's going to be qualified immunity?
My best argument is the lack of the case. There's a lack of a case from the U.S. Supreme Court that says Bell versus Wolfish is sufficient to establish the law to be clearly established in a 14th Amendment pretrial detainee case. The Supreme Court has regularly said Graham versus Connor is too high a level of generality in a use of force case. Why shouldn't that same rationale and mandate be applied in cases involving the 14th Amendment and excessive force cases brought by pretrial detainees?
I see your point on that, but are there cases that make that distinction, or is that you asking us to make that distinction for the first time?
Well, I'm asking you to follow the U.S. Supreme Court mandate on that. I'm not aware of a 10th Circuit case that says Belleville versus Wolfish is not enough, but I think this court has the opportunity to do that because it's been told multiple times by the U.S. Supreme Court that's what it has to do. Thank you,
counsel,
very much.
Yeah, your time's expired. Counsel are excused and the case is submitted. Thanks for the arguments. And we'll take a short recess before the last case.